Time for a big Friday interview this morning then. We're delighted to say we have the veteran newsman, John Snow, in the studio with us this morning. Morning to you, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Lovely to talk to you. I know we can't talk, obviously, about the detail of that case now that he's charged, John, but it'll be interesting to see if he can remain in Cabinet.
Yes. I think the smoke signals last night, at any rate, were that he probably can't. But who knows? Who knows? Let's see. But it doesn't sound as if he will.
When you're doing news every day of the week and you've got breaking stories like that, John, do you still get a buzz?
Does
the adrenaline still pump?
I absolutely do. And of course, it's a privilege to be, at the front of these things and to try to make sense of them. So, very definitely, yes.
And why do you think that is still the case after all of these years?
Well, because we're all human beings. You know, at the end of the day, communication, hearing things, learning things, telling things, it's the essence of life, isn't it?
Why did you want to be a journalist?
That's a good question, really. I mean, I wanted to make the world a better place, to be absolutely honest. I thought that it was one mechanism by which you could get to the root of things, you could expose things, and you could argue for things, you could allow people to talk in ways that might improve people's lives one way or another. I think, unfortunately, we're speaking in the midst of Leveson and the rest of it, and there must be a sense that journalism is just a scurrilous rag trade. But actually, it's a better thing than that, and it's a better thing that we're capable of doing for humankind, and I think it will get better and better from here on.
Because you worked at the very beginning with the homeless, didn't you?
I did. I went to work in a day centre for homeless teenagers and vulnerable sort of young people under 21, and I intended to work there for about 6 months. But I ended up working there 3 years, and I learnt two things. One was nobody knew how bad it was, and nobody knew what was going on. And the other thing I learnt was that I didn't have the emotional capacity to deal with the incredible scale of what young people used to bring with them into the centre. And so I realised I was better at talking about it than doing it.
Now, what do you mean you didn't have the emotional capacity? It got to you too much?
It got to me, yeah. I mean, it was exhausting. It was, particularly when people came round and round time and time again, there was a lot of drug addiction and that sort of thing, alcoholism, sort of mental difficulties and the rest of it. And I think it takes a very special kind of person to work through those things with individuals. And I didn't think I had the natural proclivities, really. I just got too emotionally involved.
And you got angry about it? Or this is interesting because I don't know you, John. I just know you through watching you on the TV. And my perception would be that you would be calm, collected, and you wouldn't get emotionally involved.
Well, no, I'm certainly not an angry person, but I'm certainly an emotional person. And I think I'm just better at, as I say, talking about it than doing it.
And how did you move in then? What was your first break into journalism?
Well, the interesting thing was actually that when I was working in this day centre, I used to write pieces and get them published in The Guardian or The New Statesman or somewhere. And also people used to come and sort of do interviews with me because we were there at the sharp end. And it was a very sharp end. We were in Piccadilly Circus. It was a time of enormous upsurge in drug abuse in London. It was the really first manifestation of the heroin sort of epidemic, coke and the rest of it, LSD. And, they wanted to talk to people who were working with people who were using this stuff.
It's a long time ago, isn't it? How long ago was that?
Well, I suppose it is a long time ago. Yes, it is about... yes, well, it's 42 years ago.
Wow.
Yes. I became a journalist sort of, I think, 36 or 7 years ago.
And you've reported here in Northern Ireland?
I have. You know, cub reporters in those days, particularly if you joined ITN, although I was at LBC first, which was a commercial station, and we used to work with Downtown and the rest. Well, yes, as a cub reporter, we were sent here to cut our teeth, not least because UTV in those days, if you can believe it, shut down at the weekend, their news operation anyway. And we used to have to come over on a Thursday night and stay through till a Monday morning to kind of nurse the baby.
And what were your impressions when you came to report here?
of absolutely extraordinarily wonderful people. That above and beyond anything else, this was an exhilarating place to come to.
See, why do people say that? Tell me why an outsider says that.
Because people are open and friendly and engaging and pleased to see you. I've just come over on the flight from London and I was with people on the flight, all of whom had Irish connections, the two people next to me. One of them, she had an Irish cousin who'd been Eleanor Roosevelt's secretary. I thought, my God, isn't that incredible? I'd never have got that information out of anybody English sitting on the plane, I can tell you. I mean, there's something much more open about people this side of the water.
Oh, tell me, I do a phone in every day of the week here, and it's the fact that people are open that keeps me in the job, for goodness sake.
Yeah, you couldn't run your programme over there, I tell you. It'd be a dead old dog.
And now, are you aware of the new Belfast? Do you come here often? The new Northern Ireland.
I confess, I haven't really been here for about 2 years, but I do come on and off, and one can only be very conscious of the new Belfast. But the old one, in its best form, hasn't gone away, and in its worst form, hopefully has.
You're in Belfast for a BBC event. You're going to be our writer in residence.
So it seems. This is a strange thing to me, but I'm going to get interviewed, I think, at a little event. And, you know, it was an excuse to come to Belfast. Who would turn that down?
Are you comfortable, John, being interviewed rather than being the interviewer?
I'm just getting to terms with it now, Stephen. I'm just sort of sorting it out as you ask me all these questions. I am comfortable with it, but it doesn't happen very often.
And because
I mean, you know, we're not supposed to have opinions. That's one of the problems.
Yeah.
And I have very strong opinions. So I have to be hosed down at regular intervals.
Well, you do. And do you find that frustrating?
Well, you know, not today, because I haven't got any minders here. You know, it's a great thing to get to my age and have people worried about what you're going to say. I like it.
Because, of course, you know, we know about the whole Poppy stuff, when you did very much give your opinion. And I thought to myself, well, hold on a minute. You know, where is the impartiality there?
It wasn't an opinion. It was a fact. You know, I mean, listen, Stephen, you and I could wear something for Marie Curie, something for AIDS, something for breast cancer, something for Poppy Day. We could be Christmas trees if we want to. I think you have to decide whether you want to make statements, and wearing a poppy is most definitely a statement. I don't want to make statements. I want to just get on with the job. And I also complained, and many people have complained since, of what I described as poppy fascism, which is where people will say, why are you not wearing a poppy? I'm sorry, but they died that we might be free to decide whether we should or we shouldn't. They didn't die so that we might be ordered to wear them. Had Hitler won, we'd have been ordered to wear a swastika. Don't let us equate the poppy with the swastika. The poppy is a thing of respect and of very treasured remembrance, and it is a very easily abused symbol. When I see people getting up 3 weeks before the first poppy gets on sale in the House of Commons, I think there's something funny going on. And when I see every single MP wearing a poppy on a particular day, I think, hang on a minute.
Well, they're doing so out of respect, John, aren't they? They're doing so out of respect. Well, they think they have to.
I think have to why? Have to because somebody may criticise them if they don't. As it happens, I do wear a poppy on Remembrance Sunday, without a doubt, when I go to church. I wear it, and with great pride, but I do not flaunt it on the television.
And did you come under... Well, I know you came under pressure.
I didn't come at any pressure at all.
Well, you came under some media pressure, didn't you?
Oh, God, but what's that? That's nothing.
What was that like?
Perfectly reasonable. We had a very interesting discussion about it, and I found that many, many people agreed with me, Stephen. Many people agreed that it was a very private decision as to what you decide to do in terms of remembering the fallen. And so I didn't come under any pressure as far as I was concerned. My editors, they were perfectly relaxed about it. The people at Channel 4, completely relaxed about it. It's a completely personal thing. And the BBC, I think, could learn a thing or two from Channel 4. When I see the serried ranks of BBC operatives having to wear poppies, that ain't good. I tell you, an MP told me that they went into a makeup parlour at the BBC Centre there in Shepherd's Bush in London, and they saw them in a jar by the makeup thing. So if you hadn't come in with one, you could pop one on, but please put it back because we're running out of them.
That's the BBC giving people a choice if they want to wear one or not.
Oh, come on. You know, you're either going to wear one because you bought one and you've made a decision to put it in your buttonhole, or you're not. I mean, you don't go into it in terms of saying, oh, comes, I haven't got one. There's one in a jar here. I'm going to stuff it on. That doesn't work at all. They didn't pay for it. They didn't make any sense of decision about it. But anyway, this is a very irrelevant conversation.
It is,
Stephen.
But you sound
this
to me.
This is going nowhere.
You sound to me like a man who wants to have opinions, who has opinions and wants to talk about them.
I don't think it's a question of opinion. It's just a fact. People. You know, make a decision, have an opinion on whether they want to wear one or not. I happen to want to wear one, but I'm not going to impose it on anybody else.
You were in Japan not even a year ago now, the devastating tsunami that swept throughout the country. And while you were there, John, you kept the video diary. Let's just have a listen to some of it.
If anywhere here can be said to be the front line, then Ofunato is it. Yeah. The bulldozers managed finally to blast their way through to the devastation. Like so many towns before, the account of loss was the same. We need repetition to represent scale, but I began to wonder whether the viewer could bear much more. This is a town where only gulls and hawks find anything of value. And it was here that we witnessed one of the most surreal moments during our time in Japan. Every day, the town sends a daily 5 o'clock music signal across its public address system to tell children the school day is over. So it is this day.
Just a sense on that, John, of the unimaginable human suffering.
You asked about emotion. I mean, it's impossible to stand there and not cry.
And yet, in front of the camera, you try not to.
Oh, of course, no. But I mean, and I think, in a way, that is how you deal with these things. I think that if you come to terms with your own emotions, and you don't deny to the viewer that it is a very, very shocking experience, you know, it helps you deal with it. Because, I mean, I can honestly say I never ever dream about what I see. It is dealt with.
You see, that's interesting, because there are some journalists I've spoken to, and maybe after 20 or 30 years in the business, of especially if they've reported from war zones or they've seen a lot of tragedy in their lives, they feel that they've been carrying it around with them for a long, long time.
No, I don't feel that at all. I feel I've shared it. I feel that I and the viewer have been on sometimes an uplifting adventure and sometimes on an utterly harrowing adventure, but we've come through it, we've looked at it, we've tried to assess what it is, and we've tried to share our feelings, and then we've moved on. I think if you let it dog you and drink you into the ground, then you know, you're going to have a rough end. You have to place it somewhere in your heart and in your mind and then move on.
What do you think, John, is the most important story you've ever covered for you?
Gosh, Stephen, I could ask you the same question. I mean, that is a very, very big question. I mean, for me, actually, I think it was covering the civil war in El Salvador in the early 1980s. But then I could equally say standing at the gates and waiting for Nelson Mandela to come out and then hearing him talking about forgiveness but not forgetting. And there are many people in this province who will share those thoughts.
I was reporting from 9/11 last year, the 10th anniversary. I was at Ground Zero, and I sat in front of a man, a first responder, and he had lost his brother at Ground Zero, and he sat and he cried in front of me, and it just brought it home to me of how sometimes, because this is what, you know, you do it on a far bigger scale than I do, but because this is what we do every single day of the week, sometimes it does become a headline, sometimes it does become a story, and sometimes I forget, and I don't know if you do, sometimes you forget about the human tragedy that is there so often, all of the time.
Well, I think, you know, in so many ways, what you're speaking to is the need for journalists and people such as ourselves, on behalf of the viewer and the listener, to go to these places and to experience what is happening. Because what the viewer and the listener looks for in what we do and why we will survive in this great digital age is somebody they trust to be their eyes and ears and hearts to some extent at these great moments in history, be they painful or uplifting. And I think that's our service.
Trust is a huge word, especially in the context of Leveson, which you mentioned earlier. Are you angry at how some of the press have behaved?
No, I'm not. I feel that those who have behaved like that are a breed apart. You know, Stephen, your programme, and I would argue, you know, BBC in Northern Ireland have not done what they've done. And I don't think I've ever really... I mean, I've stood in the pack often enough. And there are those you know are down the ratty end. And there are those who are going to keep it clean, however ratty it gets. And there is a line between the two. And those down at the ratty end are going to meet their end. And I think journalism will be a better place without them.
So do you think there will now be fundamental change? I just wonder how...
I don't, as a matter of fact. I don't. You know, look at the Gary Speed case, which is, you know, this Welsh manager who hung himself, a much-loved man. In any other season, that would have been open season, and all sorts of dreadful things would have been raked up. I'm sure we've all got dreadful things to rake up. And it hasn't really happened, and it hasn't happened because of the new climate. Now, that climate may be living on borrowed time, I don't know. But I have a feeling that even those who practice this trade have reached a point in which they know they went over the edge, and it isn't needed. The viewer and the reader and the listener are not looking for it.
But where do you think the control is going to be, John? If you've got newspapers...
Self-control, Stephen. Well, what about that? You self-control, I self-control.
Yeah, but when you've got a newspaper or any organisation and they're pursuing a story and therefore they're pursuing the person at the very heart of the story and there's a press pack outside their house and there's a press pack following them, that's been happening for so many years now. Are we really suggesting that an individual will be able to say stop and ask somebody? They were supposed to be able to ask the PCC and it didn't work.
Well, there are many individuals, aren't there, at many levels. And, of course, a huge amount of responsibility rests upon those who edit and run these organisations and these outlets. And I think that a different culture will prevail, not least because people have got other places to turn. You know, all these newspapers are losing readership all the time to the web and to the internet. And you know, interestingly, radio is sustaining, and if anything, putting on listeners, because in the new age, people can afford to be discriminating because there are many, many choices there, and the choice is generally not for filth. It may be for pornography. We know that's a bit of a driver or a big driver of the internet, but generally speaking, people are looking for information they can trust.
I'm just intrigued, John, before we end today, because I'm aware we've about 4 minutes left. 1976, you were approached by British intelligence to be a spy. Is that true?
Absolutely, 100%, yes.
What happened?
Well, I just got a letter. In fact, whilst I was transitioning from LBC to ITN, which made me think ITN maybe had a cell or something, I don't know. But it was from a Mr. Douglas Stillbury, who was an operative. I don't imagine that was his real name. But anyway, that was it. Who was an operative in SIS, the umbrella group for this intelligence services, just saying, I am engaged in some work with which I think you might be able to help. If you don't wish to avail yourself of this information, please destroy this letter. But if you are interested in going further, please contact me on the above number. It was obvious what it was. It was a letter inviting me to come in and talk to them about what they were doing. So I went in. Obviously, any hack would, I mean, to find out what was going on. And and he then asked me if I knew what SIS was, and actually I didn't. And then he said, well, you know, MI6 and all that. And I said, oh, yes. And he said, you know, we'd like you to continue with your job, but it would be other things that we'd like you to do on the side, and we would pay money into your account for a fee and all the rest of it. All very, very attractive.
Big money?
Actually, it matched what I was being paid by LBC. So I was being paid $3,000 a year by LBC, and I think they were offering me $3,000 tax free. So yeah, it was quite nice money. You know, my big problem is I can't keep secrets. So, you know, ask anybody who knows me well. I'm the first blabbermouth. So I knew that wasn't right. And also, you know, they tell me to go away and read some awful digest on how the intelligence services worked. And instead I read Kim Philby's book, A Secret War. And in that, he tells you basically that if you want to be a good spy, and I would have wanted to be a very, very good spy, you've got to spy for both sides and you end up in hell.
Would have been exciting, though.
No, it would not. This has been much more exciting. Much more exciting. Being paid to do what we do is an absolutely incredible thing, because I'd love to do it anyway.
And there are so many stories, John, that you could tell. The Idi Amin one is just incredible. You're sitting on a plane with this notorious Ugandan president, and you think to yourself, well, I'll shoot him.
Well, there was a gun. This was at the height of his bloodletting and filth, you know. I mean, I had a way in because I had known him when I was a volunteer, a teacher on VSO. I mean, very loosely. But anyway, I got into the country and got to see him, and he invited me to go to his village on his private plane. And when he got into the plane and sat down, he seemed to me to go to sleep. He was always dressed in a different fatigue. This day he was in a Texas Rangers uniform, and there was a holster and gun dangling down between the armrests, between our seats. I'm not left-handed, but I could see as he slept that I had an opportunity. But then I thought to myself, what happens if you shoot a very fat man in a very confined, high-velocity airspace and the rest of it? Does the bullet go out through him and through the fuselage and suck you out with it? Or does it revolve around inside the girth of the great man and ricochet off his bones? I couldn't tell. And as I didn't really know, I'm afraid it's down to me that he died a peaceful death beside a swimming pool in Saudi Arabia some 10 years ago.
John, welcome to Belfast. Welcome to Northern Ireland. Thank you so much for talking to us today. And I guess I'll leave my last question as this. You've talked about how long you've been in the business. And I read in some report somewhere a few weeks ago, you know, Channel 4 are talking about succession planning and all this type of stuff. Are you going to be around for a long time to come? Are you going to keep on going? Have you decided?
Well, their succession plan seems to involve me. I'm anchoring the Paralympics beginning and end, and I've done 22 years. I certainly expect to do 25, and God willing, I'll do 50.
Lovely to talk to you, John.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much indeed.